dealing with Auntie Daniels on the RBN network. Okay. Tonight's title is When Breath Becomes Air. Now, basically, the English interpretation of that is when air no longer passes through the body and just circulates out there. In other words, at the point of death. So tonight, what I'd like to do is share with you, really, the book When Breath Becomes Air. It's written by Paul Kalanithi, and he's an awesome, awesome writer. And the incredible value of this book, and I think it's going to be a classic. I hope it makes his survivors incredibly wealthy. The value of this book is he gives a classic expose of the path one takes to become a doctor. And then he gives an incredible expose of the journey of being a patient, right straight to the grave. And the beauty of this book is, although he has thoughts and contemplations during the book, it is totally expository. What does that mean? It means it has absolutely no negative judgments towards the medical system at all, yet exposes absolutely every piece of it. So what I'm going to do then is really share with you some passages in the book, what the author says, and of course, naturally, my interpretation of it. Also, I'll share with you his interpretation of it. And of course, just to give you kind of a heads up, is the shortcoming of his analysis, if you will, or his perception of his experience, is that ultimately it was totally expository in nature. In other words, as things were happening, he perceived that his only choices were how to experience this or how to think about it. It never occurred to him, just a whole vast array of choices that faced him, that he actually had. And so then he exercised, of course, none of his options, much to his detriment. So he starts out by sharing the moment that his diagnosis became clear to him. And he says, I flipped through the CT scan images, the diagnosis obvious. The lungs were matted with innumerable tumors. And over the last 6 years, I'd examined scores of such scans on the off chance that some procedure might benefit the patient. But this scan was different. It was my own. So the implication here is he's seen these x-ray results before, and he knew from his own experience that there really was no procedure that would benefit such a patient, even though in his own experience, he, you know, had sought to do this. Nevertheless, he's, by the way, a neurosurgical resident. That's important to know. And he goes on to say, 6 months before, he went to his primary care doctor, and he said an old classmate from Stanford had a sister who had died suddenly as a neurosurgery intern and contracted a virulent infection. Now, people get infections all the time. Why would a neurosurgery intern succumb to such an infection, number one? And number two, if you're, you know, thinking about this whole medical thing, if medicine is so effective, how come they couldn't save this neurosurgery intern? And so he then reflects back to the meeting that he's having with his doctor. He knows that he's got cancer. He suspects he's got cancer. And so he says to his doctor, you know, I'd like to get an MRI to be sure. And the doctor says, eh, we should get x-rays. You know, we've got this new cost-saving thing going on, and so we're going to start with the cheapest x-ray. And so he says to himself, well, wait, it depends on what you're looking for, and x-rays are useless for cancer. And so He sits here as a patient witnessing this doctor ordering a useless test because it's less expensive. And this is something the medical industrial complex does a lot. When they are charged with saving money, cutting back expenses, they institute a supposed cost-saving measure that actually multiplies costs. So in other words, if you can look at a patient, examine the patient, you know what it is, you can order the test most likely to confirm your findings, and then you're done with it, as opposed to ordering three or four inexpensive tests and then ordering the one that would be confirmatory. And so he then reflects, as he's sitting in front of his doctor, why was I so authoritative as a surgeon in a surgeon's coat, but so meek in a patient's gown? And he said, the truth was, I knew more than my doctor did. And so this is a common experience patients have, and this is exactly what he's experiencing. And even though he knows more than his doctor, he decides to submit. And he says, well, in the past, I would take a healthy dose of ibuprofen to get through the day. 10 years of relentless training, that would be 4 years of medical school, 6 years of neurosurgical residency, I had earned the respect of my seniors, won prestigious national awards, and had job offers from major universities. Now here we see is really the crux of what's wrong with his life and what's wrong with medicine, which is that he measures himself by enduring of training program, by external measures. In other words, because he completed someone else's program, he met someone else's criteria, he earned the respect of other people, he won awards from others for doing, of course, things that they approved of, and he received job offers from, again, several major universities, not minor. And so when you have a life centered around external approval, then you basically have no self-approval or self-respect, and you tend not to make decisions that might be better for your health. And so he said, I had reached the mountaintop, I could see the promised land, and finally see myself becoming the husband I'd promised to be. Then a few weeks later, chest pain, night sweats, dripping sweats, persistent cough, classic, of course, cancer symptoms. And then he decides to take a break and go get some ice cream. And then he decides, well, I'll have a few cocktails. And he decides that, talking to his wife, you know, our marriage is not doing great, but yeah, it's just residency. It'll strain our marriage. And he says, we were so close to the life we always wanted. And, of course, his wife says, hey, wait a minute, guy. You really think things are going to be better when you get that big job in the sky where you're going to be working still 100 hours a week? And then he confides to the reader that he did do 36-hour shifts straight in the operating room. I've been in the operating room. I've done surgeries. And let me tell you, a 45-minute surgery is a lot to endure. Because you're wearing scrubs, on top of that you're wearing a sterile gown, on top of that you've got the hat, you've got the gloves, you've got the booties, and so a real super, super easy situation to overheat, get faint, and very, very unhealthy. So he goes on to say, well, I'd have back spasms that were so bad I had to grind my teeth, and he says he knew a lot about back pain, but I didn't know what my patients were feeling. I didn't know what it felt like. And he, you know, went on to say that this is really tough being in the operating room with all of this pain. So then he decides to go visit his friends, decides to have some scotch, and he now revisits the situation where he's sitting talking to his doctor, and now subsequent tests have come back, and it's pretty straightforward. And so His doctor said she wasn't sure what it meant. And he says, she likely knew what it meant. I knew. And so we have here an example of he's got this serious illness. The doctor is obviously lying to him. He knows the doctor is lying to him. And, you know, he doesn't call her on it. He decides, okay, we're gonna go with this. And he says, the future I had imagined about to be realized, decades of striving evaporated. And this is another issue with the doctors go through is once you start, take that first step towards being a doctor in your mind, whether it's that first step into undergraduate and you've got it figured out in your mind, you're going to do 4 years of undergraduate, 4 years of medical school, 3, 6, 9, 10 years of residency and then practice and then get on your feet financially. It's really a 20-year plan. You're really looking 20 years down the road. And what happened to this individual is he did that. He looked 20 years down the road and forgot about the present day, forgot about the decisions he was making each day that would ultimately compromise that 20-year scenario. And so, of course, we find out his doctor, his uncle is a doctor, his brother's a doctor, his father's a doctor, and he really wanted to be a writer. But what caught his attention was he wanted to know more. He wanted to know more about the experience that patients have as they face death. And this is what kept him really interested. So he decided the mind was simply the operation of the brain. And that the brain was, of course, machinery, which means the mind was machinery. And so he decided that the way to find out about this was biology and neuroscience. And he felt that literature was the best account of the life of the mind, but neurosurgery, neuroscience, laid down the most elegant rules of the brain. And so he pauses to say, if the unexamined life is not worth living, is the unlived life worth examining? And so it's finally dawning on him that in his haste to get an education, in his haste to find out more and to pursue neuroscience, he actually wasn't living his life. By living his life, I would say, that would mean him consciously making decisions about his life every day. So in other words, he was on a track that was previously laid out. And so this is really what happens to just classically in medical school or in the medical educational process is human beings are literally putting their control over their lives, their decision-making, human autonomy, voluntarily putting it on hold and actually not living your life. They literally, it's like hitting the pause button on your life at 18 and then at somewhere between the age of 30 and 40, hitting the play button again. And so literally at age somewhere between 30 and 40, you hit play, your emotional development, your exercise of adult prerogatives, such as they may be, literally begins at the 18-year mark. It's almost like you've been in suspended animation. And so he said he's briefly considered issues such as ethics, and he was studying animals for different animal cultures. But he wanted to understand meaning, everyday life, just this, the meaning of life. And he studied to try and understand what makes life meaningful. And he decided that only by going to medical school, becoming a neurosurgeon, could he really get a grip on this. And he went to see a home for people who had suffered severe brain injuries on his way before he went to medical school. And when the adults expressed that it's hard to care for these kids, and of course their family is going to abandon him. He said, well, this is just terrible. But he realized that sometimes brains break. What he failed to observe was that scientists don't seem to be able to fix these broken brains. So, of course, he went on to get a master's in English literature at Stanford, and then he went on to study history of medicine in Cambridge, England, and then returned, of course, to Yale to go to medical school, where he graduated. And so he said there must be a way to understand passion, hunger, love, language of neurons, digestive tracts, and heartbeats. And so he decided all of these things, these emotions, could be interpreted into a language of neurons and digestion and heartbeats. And this is what he sought to sort out. Another thing that's interesting is he, as a child, his mother wanted him to have a very good education. And his father, who was a doctor, moved to the Midwest so he could have a better standard of living, because he realized that on a doctor's income, he really couldn't live provide for his children what he wanted to in New York City, which is where they started out life. And so his mother, of course, got the reading list from Ivy League schools and had him start reading these things at a very young age. And he then reads these things, the college prep reading list, and it completes this list by the time he was 10 years old. And he, as a result of reading these things, determined that happiness was not the point of life. And he kept reading more books to get more views of the world. And these books actually shaped his thinking and, unfortunately, I think, created a shortcut. And so what he would do is he would think something would happen in life and he would interpret, oh, that's like this book. Oh, that's like that book. Rather than saying, hey, wait a minute, this is not a book. This is my life. What is going on? And like I said, failed to see the signposts of danger as it came. And so he felt then that the great literary works provided their own set of tools, compelling the reader to use that vocabulary. And so literally, he molded his mind to the vocabulary and to the reasoning processes he read in these wonderful classic books, I'm sure. And he felt he didn't want to go into literature because it was overly political and averse to science. Of course, he was ultimately going to find out that medicine was very political and averse to science. But as a person starting again on that first step of the journey, that wasn't obvious to him. And he wrote a thesis in his English master's degree called The Medicalization of Personality. And of course, it was well received. And that's what we find today is the medicalization of personality. People are told, you take this pill to be happy, you take this pill to wake up, you take that pill to go to sleep, and you take another pill to get through daily annoyances. And so he believed Walt Whitman himself, who wrote, "The only the physician could truly understand the physiological spiritual man." And this is what made him decide to go to college. I mean, to medical school. And again, this is something, when I was in medical school, and it was explained to me that only doctors could understand certain things, that only doctors could understand, because other people who hadn't experienced this level of education and refinement just couldn't grasp certain things. And I absolutely did not accept that, but our author does accept this.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AirOutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AirOutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magful clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AirOutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AirOutfitting.com.
People love to shop. What if you could shop and it was actually good for you? What if you could actually purchase items that bettered your life? What goes into your body is important to what quality of life you have. How about shopping for items that better your health? GetTheTea.com is that shopping place. We're not only tea, even though that's our number one seller, we are about helping your health. There's colostrum LD for those of you with autoimmune troubles. The product helps your stomach get on track. GI problems produce pain. Get relief with colostrum LD. How about some fat burners? Or maybe some joint aid? Or a power cleanse? There's so much to tell you with very little time. So get help health-wise at GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. Or you can call our friendly operators at 928-308-0408. That's 928-308-0408. Get help and relief by going shopping. Shop at GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. Serving people with great products for over 8 years. GetTheTea.com.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers, have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
Hi, this is Dr. Daniels, and welcome back to Healing with Dr. Daniels. And tonight we're talking about when breath becomes air. And this is really an awesome book, and it just totally exposes the whole medical system from the doctor point of view as well as from the patient point of view. So the author ultimately ends up going to medical school. And on his way, he says, he wanted to find answers that are not in books, answers to relationship with the suffering, the meaning of life, what makes it meaningful, even in the face of death and decay. This is what he wanted to find out, and this is why he went to medical school. And he felt speculation was puny compared to action, and he then went on to Yale Medical School. Now, this is important. He went to medical school to find answers that are not in books, answers concerning the relationship with the suffering and what makes human life meaningful even in the face of death and decay. This is the answer he sought. So he wasn't seeking to heal anyone, to cure anyone. He wanted to know what makes life meaningful even in the face of death and decay. Now, I went to medical school because I wanted to help people get better. And so I was immediately shocked and appalled at the very low success rate. But this is not what he was striving to do. So as you might guess, the low success rate didn't strike him as an indication that the therapy was ineffective or even inappropriate. And so he says, here in medical school, you're violating society's most fundamental taboos. Cadaver dissection epitomizes the transformation of the respectful student into the callous, arrogant doctor. And that is exactly the case. The anatomy class is itself so superficial that the only thing that really happens in the class is that you get accustomed to inflicting mutilation and damage on a human on the human form. And so anatomy professors, he says, advise us students to leave the face covered of the cadaver. It makes the work easier. And, of course, the analogy is that in a hospital, putting a patient in a hospital gown also makes it easier. It makes it easier to torture the patient, easier to abuse the patient, to humanize the patient and not treat them with respect. And he says about his cadaver, the professor says, the cadaver probably died of pancreatic cancer, though there's no scar for that because the cancer killed him too quick and surgery, of course, could not be performed. And so what the professor is really saying here, which is stunning, is that had the patient had the pancreatic surgery for his cancer, he still would have been killed by the disease. In which case, then, the doctor is the instructor is saying, well, this cadaver would have had surgery, which we know to be futile, but it would have been appropriate. And, of course, again, that's another thing that would perk your ears up and get your attention if you went to medicine to heal people. But if you went to medicine to understand the meaning of life in the face of suffering, this is, of course, one more step in the journey. And so in the cadaver's stomach, they found two undigested morphine pills. In other words, this person had died in pain. In other words, they received ineffective pain relief. So these morphine pills were not effective in relieving the pain. And so he then says, by the way, initially when medical schools were started, medical students had to go out and kill people, bring them to the school in order to dissect them. And this was like, okay. And then they would rob graves to get bodies for dissection. But now we ask people to make donations of their bodies. And of course he wonders, would they really donate their body if they saw the disgraceful way that medical students were treating their bodies, cutting out their parts, tossing them around the room, and so on. And again, the whole exercise of anatomy class and dissecting a cadaver is to transform the student into the callous doctor. And then he says to his professor, well, why don't we tell people when they donate their bodies that this is really what's going to happen? And the professor says, you wouldn't tell a patient the gory details of a surgery if that would make them not consent. He didn't even say, would you? He just said, period. Well, you just don't do that. If you want people to do something, you don't tell them the gory details of a surgery if that would make them not consent. And so again, he, as a medical student, he's being trained by his professor to lie to patients by omission in order to get their consent. And this is the way medical school is. It's just a tiptoe, tiptoe, tiptoe. It's the, step by step by step, training the student to lie to himself, to lie to patients, and to really be totally dishonest. It's a very corrupting process. And so he goes on to say, it was not a simple evil. All of medicine invades the body in every way imaginable. Doctors escort patients into the world and then back out. And he accepts this as the flip side to easing the most profound human suffering. And so, again, he's looking at human suffering, facing human suffering, not at relieving it, only easing it, and not to reverse a patient's condition at all. This is like totally okay with him. And so suffering then, he says, becomes a mere pedagogical tool, which is a nice word and it helps the book flow, but it means teaching. So suffering becomes simply a tool for teaching. And this is exactly the atmosphere in medical school. Incredible, overwhelming amount of suffering, which is often worsened by the therapy, by the painful tests, by the side effects of drugs that don't in any way improve the patient. And as a student, it's one's responsibility to stand by and observe this. And then he makes a digression by mentioning, or actually maybe he brings the point home by mentioning he and his wife. We're going to watch, when we come back, we'll continue that.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Extendivite, a 7-herb combination of garlic, cayenne, hawthorn, bilberry, ginkgo biloba, valerian, and milk thistle. Extendivite is designed to strengthen the heart and arteries and help the body heal itself. Doctors are not able to explain the improvements they are seeing in their patients' health who are taking Extendivite. People who once needed more pills are now taking less and getting better. Due to the unexplainable improvements in their patients' health, more doctors are calling to order Extendivite for themselves. Help Extendivite make your doctor a believer. Extendivite is available in capsule or liquid form for just $69.95 for a 2-month supply. To get started, call 1-877-928-8822, that's 1-877-928-8822, or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Give such delight.
Healing with Dr. Daniels. Okay, so we're doing a review, When Breath Becomes Air. And so he goes on to say, to note that he and his wife are watching, looking at an EKG, and it went from a regular rhythm to a squiggle to a straight line. And of course, she realized, oh my God, this person died, and she cried. And he thought this was an exceptional amount of sensitivity to not only realize the patient had died, but to cry about it. And so this is the type of really insensitivity that medical school works very hard to cultivate. And so he goes on to say he intended medical school to bear witness to the mysteries of death. And in one of his, in a book written by a doctor, How We Die, there's a story written that the resident, or young doctor, is covered in blood and failure as he tried to save the person's life, but of course failed. And he said, medical school had changed by the time I got there. We were hardly allowed to touch patients, but the blood and failure part still remained, and the true image of a doctor and the heroic spirit of responsibility. And so what he's saying then is it's the doctor's lot to be covered in blood and failure, and that's okay. So with the high prices they're charging, it's okay to not give the person concrete results. And this, of course, is shocking. And so he then tells a story of a lady pregnant with twins in the hospital. They're monitoring her. The twins are doing poorly. They do an emergency C-section. And, of course, 2 days later, both babies are dead, and the mother has been, of course, sliced open with a large wound that has a risk for being infected. She now has an increased risk of death herself, and all this for a procedure that resulted in two dead children. Now, the author reflects back, well, hey, my brother was like way premature, many weeks premature, 12 weeks, almost 8 weeks premature. He was in excellent health. Of course, when I was in medical school, they said, what is the first baby? Always the first baby is premature. Why? Because nobody wants to admit that the pregnancy predates the wedding. And so if his second baby had been premature 8 weeks, it might have been different. But of course, the first baby is always premature and always, of course, in excellent health and full size. So he then asked the doctor, geez, was the emergency C-section appropriate? So he asked the senior. Senior person says, absolutely. It was the only choice these kids had, their only chance, and that's what we had. That's what we did, and we did the right thing. And it's really another step, again, in medical school, we're taught to go for the futile, go for the most costly, most traumatic intervention that has the least amount of opportunity to cause benefit. And so then he's talking to his senior instructor, and senior instructor says, "You think that's bad? Most mothers with stillborns still have to go through labor and delivery." And of course, labor and delivery is much safer for the mother. There's no incision. Recovery is instantaneous, basically 2 days to a week, if she has a vaginal birth, even though it might be a deceased baby. And so, again, in medical school, we're trained to somehow believe that a C-section is just quick, instant, no problem. But I can tell you that it's absolutely not true. And so he then asked her, well, what happens if you don't do the C-section? Well, so the babies die. He says, well, wait a minute. We did the C-section, the baby died. How do you decide? She shrugged her shoulders. Judgment call. Which means there is no scientific method at all to determining this. It's just capricious. And then he says, his colleagues going through medical school are focusing on lifestyle. And of course, he was puzzled by the fourth year of medical school when one by one the classmates elected to specialize in less demanding areas. And he was puzzled. Of course, you stop and think about it, it makes a lot of sense. If the patient's not going to benefit, at least the doctor should pick an area where the doctor's not going to suffer. And so the focus on lifestyle, specialties, humane hours, higher salaries, lower pressure. And he says, not me. I chose neurosurgery. And again, it's a false belief of either or, that either you're a good doctor or you have humane hours. And what he didn't realize, of course, by taking a residency with 100-hour work weeks, he was destroying his health. And so he had a child as a patient who had a large brain tumor, and the mother, of course, was a radiologist. And he realized that all he could do for them was, it was a question of intersecting life, death, and meaning. And he felt that this arose usually in a medical context, therefore become a doctor to witness this in the medical context. And he decided from, again, extensive reading, that diseases are just molecules misbehaving. And so, of course, this is the theory of disease that all doctors are taught in medical school, that molecules are just misbehaving, and that's what disease is. And so, of course, with that model, you would never figure that constipation could cause disease, right? Because it's just molecules misbehaving. And so, of course, As a medical student, I would say, well, wait a minute. If there's just molecules misbehaving, why don't we just give them a lecture or give them a pep talk or something like that? Why would adding drugs handle the misbehaving of molecules? And, of course, once you understand natural healing, you realize you've got to get out the waste products and the parasites that cause disease. So the molecules misbehaving theory doesn't allow for parasites as a cause of disease. It doesn't allow for poisons as a cause of disease. It doesn't allow for malnutrition as a cause of disease. It is actually fundamental mysticism. And so when I was in medical school, I recognized that immediately. I said, whoa, wait a minute. What happened to science? But again, he's looking at meeting people in their suffering, and so this went just over his head. And so he said, neurosurgeons work on a crucible of identity. Brain surgery is the most dramatic event in a person's life. And extremely true. It is a bunch of drama. That it benefits them, hard to say. And so what he says is, if a neurosurgeon, you ask people, would you trade your ability to talk for a few extra months of life? And again, this presumes that the person really would get a few extra months of life as a result of surgery. But that's not guaranteed. That they would lose their ability to talk, of course, is guaranteed. What about making their blind spot larger to reduce the possibility of a fatal brain hemorrhage? In other words, they might still get the fatal brain hemorrhage, but they would also have the larger blind spot. And so he goes through all of these atrocious trade-offs where the benefit, of course, is in no way guaranteed, but of course the harm is. And he says, ideally, with a doctor as a guide to answer these questions, and this is what the question to be answered is, what makes life meaningful enough to go on living? And I know I'm 59 years old, by the way, and certainly when I was a child, when I was 5, 10, 20, well, before I went to college, I found people making this decision, what makes life meaningful enough to go on living, they made this decision all the time without any assistance or even input of medical doctors. And this is another thing that medical school trains you, is the arrogance of thinking that grown adults cannot make huge life decisions without dramatic interventions like brain surgery. And so he goes on, of course, this is the most challenging residency, and the idea was intoxicating that he could join the ranks of those who stood in the densest thicket of emotional, scientific, spiritual problems and carved ways out. Again, of course, you carve a way out for the person, but that way out may be, of course, the casket or the grave. And as an intern, he realized he was a paper pusher, but the workload was enormous, and they would pat him on the back and say, make us proud. And he took that seriously, too, of course, that, again, his sense of pride wasn't internal, it was external, by pleasing people, by rising to this occasion. And so what then happened is he ended up living on energy drinks, Diet Coke, ice cream sandwiches, in order to get through these 100-hour weeks. And so, of course, as he's entering, the leaving resident says, they can always hurt you more, but they can't stop the clock. So if you can hang in there 6 years, then you've basically won. And you have to question a training process that specializes in harming and literally torturing the people who submit to it. And so he talks about an 8-year-old patient with a tumor in the hypothalamus. And the surgeon removed the tumor, and they decided it was a success. The patient went home. And, of course, 2 years later, they find out the surgery had actually failed and was all for naught. And the child ended up being institutionalized. And so story after story after story, he talks of the different failures. And so this one is very telling. It's one of the 880,000 people every year that's killed as a result of surgery. And he says, it's an 82-year-old woman, small and trim, the healthiest person on the general surgery service. Did a minor operation sometime after midnight. She crashed, and she was not improving. They transferred her to the intensive care unit, and 2 days later, she died. Now, she had a minor surgery. Before she went into surgery, she was the healthiest person, had a minor surgery, and then dies. Obviously, no matter what happened, we don't need to even know what happened, the surgery itself was a contributor to her death. In other words, had she not had this minor surgery, she would be alive. And so, in the first year, he says, I would glimpse my share of death. And he lists, it's an exhaustive list of all the people who died. And some days, it says, like a suffocating weight of its own, and the families of the, and the rain of tears of the families of the dying pouring down. And it is shocking that you would need the tears of the family to yourself be troubled by this death. You know, personally, I didn't get a chance to see a whole lot of tears just because of the way this program was structured, but I was very troubled by the degree of death that I saw. Again, at a minimum, you have to conclude the therapy that you're training to administer is simply not that effective. And he says, not all residents could stand the pressure. And of course, others, he said, would pay an even higher price, as he talks about a resident who dropped out. And of course, he did not know that he would soon pay the ultimate price, which of course is with his life. And so he was very excited about a career where he could pursue death, to grasp it, unlock it, see it eye to eye, unblinking, truly life and death decision and struggles. Surely transcendence will be found there. And meanwhile, of course, the people that he was treating, you imagine the carnage. And so he hears that, so he's grabbing his typical lunch, Diet Coke and ice cream sandwich. Again, those of you who are aficionados of natural healing realize that this is basically kind of cancer in half an hour. So, of course, there's no mystery how or why he got cancer. But anyways, grabbing his typical lunch, and he hears that a friend of his had died. And, oh, I'm sorry, that a person rolled into the emergency room with a head trauma. And so he said, I was already planning the scalp incision. It's a whirlwind of activity. Catheter slipped into his femoral arteries. Tubes shoved up his chest. Drugs pushed into his IVs. All of this drama. And 30 minutes later, we decide to let him finish dying. With that kind of head injury, we all murmured in agreement. Death was to be preferred. And then the family was brought into view, the body, which had been totally, you know, desecrated with all these tubes and everything. And, you know, he again, this did not faze him, or at least it didn't cause him to question the actual value of what he was involved in. So a few days later, he heard a friend of his died of a head injury following a car accident. And he reviewed in his mind everything he had done to people in a similar situation. He realized all these things were done to her, that she was put on a gurney, that tubes were probably shoved down her throat. They pounded on her chest. They probably shaved her scalp. They cut her skull open with a drill. And all of this stuff. And ultimately, of course, she dies. And he said he didn't ask for details because he already knew too many. And this epitomizes what's really going on. It's just an extremely, extremely expensive, very lucrative drama to dazzle and amaze the patient and family while enriching the medical industrial complex. Now, his role in this as a trainee, of course, he was severely underpaid, but everything he did was billed at top dollar, and that money went to either a senior doctor or to the hospital. That's just the way medicine is run. So he feared he was on the way to becoming Tolstoy's doctor, preoccupied with empty formalism, rote treatment of disease, utterly missing the larger human significance. Of course, yes. And so then he decides that the highest ideal was not saving lives, but guiding family to an understanding of death or illness. And again, guiding someone to an understanding acceptance of death and illness, well, this is really a role of a minister, a preacher, a religious guide. And so for a doctor to slice someone up, put them under anesthesia, fill them with drugs, charge them all this money and say, okay, now it's time to just help you understand death and illness. And so he goes on with this. When we come back, we'll find out more about this situation.
You, your husband, your wife, your children, we all need food. And with dozens of food storage companies buying up airtime all over radio, it's hard for you to know which company you can actually trust. Hey folks, John Stettmiller here. We at RBN understand, which is why I personally searched out a storable food company and one with similar core values to us here at RBN and, of course, you, the listener. Well, I found such a company. I'd like to introduce you to Numana Food Storage. Numana Food Storage, highly nutritious, GMO-free, contains no aspartame, no high fructose corn syrup, has no chemical preservatives or soy, and Numana Food Storage has a 25-year shelf life. To back up my claims, we've made Numana Food Storage the exclusive food sponsor of RBN. Call 888-597-0775, 888-597-0775. Order online at numanarepublic.com. That's NUMANARepublic.com. Food storage you'll love to eat.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AROutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus magful clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AROutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AROutfitting.com.
Are you still looking for that one iodine that you can really trust? A medical doctor-endorsed product that is backed by honest research and true integrative science? Then search no further. Go to NutraMedical.com for Dr. Bill Deagle's Nutriodine, proven time and time again to be the very best iodine available for you. Nutriodine is the only Tesla-activated monatomic plasma iodine in the world. It optimizes mitochondrial function and generation of new mitochondria from totally neutralizing the venom from a desert recluse spider bite in Southern California to eliminating malaria parasites reported by medical missionaries in Central India. Dr. Bill's Nutriodine is simply the most powerful healing formula there is. Nutriodine clears the body of all known pathogens, restores it to an alkaline state, and even promotes stem cell regeneration. Order Dr. Bill's Nutriodine today at 888-212-8871 or visit us online at NutraMedical.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Daniels, and welcome back to Healing with Dr. Daniels. Okay, when breath becomes air. And so, kind of our last entry here in terms of his discussion about neurosurgery, and this is really shocking, but it's typical of a lot of medicine. He says, removing the tumor was satisfying, even though I knew microscopic cancer cells had already spread throughout the healthy-looking brain. The nearly inevitable recurrence was a problem for another day. And so basically this was his lot. This was his day-to-day work in a 100-hour work week. And so finally, He experiences his personal, I guess you could say, personal tragedy. And what he finds is that he himself has cancer. And so then he goes to his doctor, and the doctor basically says to him, he says, well, so he's saying, my identity as a physician, my identity no longer mattered. The diagnosis was clear. So in other words, he realized that there is no effective therapy and no cure for his condition. Just by looking at his x-ray, he knew this. And so he said, instead of being the pastoral figure aiding a life transition, I found myself the sheep. And we know what happens to sheep. Of course, sheep are always slaughtered. And so I should have been able to see and follow the footprints of the countless patients I had treated over the years, but a blank, harsh, vacant, gleaming white desert was there. And he's saying, this is, and so this is exactly the footsteps his patients followed. In other words, he had no clue as to what the path really felt like. And this is where he had led his patients down this path. And so his future doctor drops by his hospital bed that night before leaving to pick up her kids. Of course, she had a life. And he says to her, hey, what do you think? And she says, well, we can talk about therapies later, and we're going to get you back to work. And he says, what? Go back to work? What is she talking about? Is she delusional? Am I dead wrong about my prognosis? And how can we talk about any of this without a realistic estimate of survival? And so the doctor actually refuses to talk to him about survival, but just therapies, and we're going to treat you. And so, of course, she immediately starts out with false hope. He realizes his hope is false, but he bites at it. And so she says, well, are you any more questions? Don't ask me about survival, but any other questions? And he says, no, thanks, which is basically thanks for nothing. Now, of note, 18 months earlier, he'd had appendicitis. In other words, he had a warning that he was toxic, that he was basically constipated.
I saw you there, just standing there, and I thought I was only dreaming, yeah. I kissed you then, and then once again.
Extendivite is more than just a heart tonic. Most basic diseases are caused by yeast in the gut and metals in the liver, and we all have a bit of both. The garlic in Extendivite has a yeast-killing effect in the gut while also helping the sulfur enzyme in the liver get rid of the metals. Extendivite just may improve your overall health. Products like Extendivite are the only way we are going to get our society healthy. And if you're waiting for the government and pharmaceutical care to solve your health problems, you're going to have a long, disappointing wait, I think. Extendivite is a complete formula for extended life in the new millennium. 80 can be the new 60. Extendivite is available in capsule or liquid form for just $69.95 for a two-month supply. To get started, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Hi, this is Dr. Daniels, and welcome back to Healing with Dr. Daniels. And today we're taking a look at